12th, I want to go ahead and call to order the special meeting of the Port Commission of the Port of Houston Authority. Thanks for a packed house today. Must be an interesting topic, I guess. So just a couple of housekeeping things I want to visit with everyone about before we get started. And that is that, so the format today, we're here to talk about funding for the deepening and widening of the ship channel. And I want to just make sure that we all understand the how we're going to run the meeting today, and then also what the point is, right? So we all know that the Houston Ship Channel needs to be deepened and widened. It's our number one priority that we've been talking about for the last, you know, at least 18 months. And we're making a lot of progress in Washington, D.C. We've had multiple delegations that have gone to D.C. As recently as last Thursday, we testified in front of the House Ways and Means Subcommittee on Trade, on how infrastructure and trade go together hand in hand. Made a lot of other stops with congressional leaders and in D.C. I appreciate the support that we've received from industry, going up on their own and with commissioners from the Port Authority. So we are as a team trying to get this done together. We know it takes a team, and it's not just one group that gets it done. And so we're really excited about where we are in the process. Roger's going to update you with where we are in the process and the progress we've made, which has been significant in the last 3 or 4 months. I want to just sort of start by saying that the Houston Ship Channel will be deepened and widened. The question is, how soon, right? Under the normal sort of process, we would be looking at, and this is federal process, funding approvals and all the details that get into how fast you can get it done. We will get it done. There's no question. The question is when. And if we go through a normal process, we've talked about this, the normal sort of pay-as-you-go process for the federal government, with the port contributing its share and the federal government contributing its share, we're looking best case 2031-32 to finish to deepen and widen the channel. So the question today is, how do you change that metric? How do we as a team and as a group and as a community make that happen faster? Now, we know what happens if it takes that long. It costs more. It costs us jobs. It costs us business. It costs the community a lot of negative things. And so the meeting today is to talk about not if we will widen or deepen, but when will we widen and deepen. And that's the I think the important thing for us all to focus on, because the industry has over the last 6 or 8 months had a lot of discussion about paying for half the cost, and we know that there's been a lot of discussions, and now we have a proposal from industry that we're going to look at today and talk about. Now, this is the first sort of public airing of it. Now, there have been lots of meetings between Roger and his team and industry leaders, and the challenge that the Port Commission has, obviously, is we can't all be in those meetings for obvious reasons. So today will be the first time that we as a group, and I think the folks here that are attending this meeting as a group, sort of hear the details of what the plan is so far. It is a plan in progress, and I want to emphasize that. You know, we're not done. We think that we just need to vet it and make sure that we understand what the proposal is at this point. So the way the meeting is going to be run today, I'm gonna ask Roger to kind of update us on where things are, and then I'm going to ask Vincent DeCosmo, who is here. Vincent, thanks for being here. Who's going to make a presentation to the commission on the progress of where we are and what the proposal, sort of as it stands, is today. And then after we'll do Q&A during that period with commissioners. After Vincent and the Q&A is done, then we'll ask for other public comment. You don't have to sign up. What we'll do is just ask the group if anyone wants to to address the group or ask questions, we're happy to let you do that. There will be a 3-minute time limit on those questions so that we aren't here all day, and then you can speak for 3 minutes, and then if there's questions and answer questions, that's fine. The commission will ask questions, and you won't be limited on that. So that's what we're going to do today. This is the meat of the meeting. We will have a short executive session to deal with some other matters that will happen after we go through this process. So any questions or? Okay, Roger.
Good. Well, thank you, Chairman and Commissioners, and good morning, everybody. We've got a good representation of our entire channel industry here today, and again, I think it's important. Give you a brief update on kind of where we are with the project as we move forward. Just quick overview, the feasibility, talk about on track there, doing the design work, that's in progress. Advocacy, as Rick talked about, is really been influential, and the active discussion on funding agreements continue, and obviously we talked about more today. I thought it important too, just to kind of highlight to everybody the scope of the project, if you will. There are several segments. If you look down in the Bay Reach, there's 1A, B, and C. That's the widening of that Bay Reach from 530 to 700 feet. We have some improvements there. Number two in the green is for the Bayport Terminal, and number three is for the Bayport Channel. Moving further up, there's a project, segment number four is a deepening from 40 to 45 feet above the Beltway 8 bridge, and a small amount of deepening there in segment five, and then some deepening further up into the Turning Basin in segment six. So each of those, we have the current core estimates for costs for each of those segments. As you can see, $127 million for 1A, $168 for 1B, $140 for 1C, if you can't see those back there, $88 million for Bayport, $154 for Barber Scut, $225 for the deepening in segment four, and then $7 million and $49 million. All total, the current estimate is $960 million for this.
It's going in the right way.
It's going in the right way. It's nominally a billion. You know, that includes a lot. I think it includes also some pipeline relocations and everything. That's the kitchen sink right there. So just to kind of give everybody an idea of what we're doing. So we've been working together. Just real quick, back in October, November, we have this roadmap that where we're talking about feasibility, we're talking about advocacy, and we're talking about funding. Collectively, we're doing a lot of things as a group and as an industry. So that's kind of shows where we were. Where we are today, we're checking a lot of boxes. You know, here we are almost to March on the feasibility side. I'll talk about all these in a little more detail. But just to kind of give you the sense, we're moving in the right direction. We're in a good place, but there's still a lot ahead of us that we need to complete and come to completion of this project together. I'll go through each one of these a little bit, but the part now on the funding side is where we're at today. This is kind of where we're at for the discussion. The commitment that we have at the port and the commitment of the industry, you know, to pay for this thing 50-50, running many different models, looking at very different debt and debt financing opportunities or whatever. But again, that kind of leads us to where we are right now. So just to summarize a few things, I told you the core process is on track. Feasibility was submitted in December on time. We had a tier one meeting. That's with the highest level of the core, myself and Rich and several others. It was the general from the division, and of course Colonel Vail, and some planning people from headquarters, just to make sure we're on track. The whole mission right now is to make sure that we get that chief's report in time to go into a word of bill. So the Corps has indicated in a hearing that General Semonite had where they may be ahead of schedule. So we're certainly in position to make that chief's report completion in April, or maybe end of April, or maybe sooner. So we're continuing to monitor that and make sure that stays on track and nothing changes. As far as the design work, you may be aware, the port made the commitment, I think it was November or December, awarded the largest engineering contract that we've ever done, making that commitment to start the design on behalf of the Corps, to get that out of the way, to make sure that when this thing is off, when this channel is authorized, we're ready to begin into the construction phase. So that's ongoing. The Corps is reviewing this, and there was a major occurrence that we found out on Monday. We got included in the 2020 work plan, $1.13 million. That's a very valuable $1.13 million, because what that does is give the funds to the Corps to make sure that they can continue to review this design all the way to completion. So that was critical. And I have to mention as well, and I think it's a testament to our advocacy efforts, we found out early in the week in the work plan as well, we got $70 million, $70.3 million this year for O&M to maintain our channel. If you recall, we began getting $20 or $30 million a year. This year, we got $70 million in order to do the necessary things to get the channel in a condition so that we can start this project. So tremendous news. It was worthy of Congressman Babin calling Rick and myself yesterday personally to make sure we knew this. So advocacy, as Rick said, many different hearings, talking to Congress, very active delegation involvement, and there's several scheduled upcoming, but we've been jointly meeting everyone that we can, whether it's with the administration or our members of Congress, OMB, whoever we can talk to, and I can tell you that this project is very visible in DC. We have Big Ten meetings weekly. I think those are very helpful to make sure we're on the same page and that we're pushing in the right direction as we advocate. As far as funding, weekly discussions. Rick mentioned we've had several discussions on the topic today with Vincent. And, the port is committed. We're committed, obligated to our 35% share and the LPP, to keep this going in the right direction. So our commitment is there, as well as pre-funding some of the design efforts that we had. So we got this financing concept, funding concept that Vincent's going to talk about today in November. A little detail in December, had some discussions in December, and we've been evaluating, but the issue is we need to come to closure on how we're going to fund this project quickly. The reason for that is at some point, we're working on this in parallel, we need to have a PPA, it's a project partnership agreement, in place and determined. This is a contract with the Port Authority and the federal government, a binding contract for what this, how this project is going to be funded and how it's going to be executed. That needs to be in place, be ready to sign the minute that we get authorization, and it's not too late. In order to do that, we need to know how the funds are going to be contributed and when in order to execute this project. So the bringing closure and to this subject of how the funds are going to be, how they're going to be available, and how quickly we can execute this project are really driven by this project partnership agreement. So with that being said, I'll turn it back to Rick or turn it over to Vincent, however you want to go here to give a presentation.
Well, before we do that, are there any questions any commissioners have of Roger and the process or where we are or anything like that?
Not for me.
I don't have any. Just want to thank Roger and his staff for the hard work they've done continuously since we've run into this problem. It's been an ongoing thing from everybody, and I appreciate it. We're headed in the right direction.
Well, thanks, but, you know, I get to go to these tier one meetings, so I can go down there with all the smart people to answer all the questions and make sure we're on track. So we got a large group in our organization making sure this happens, so I thank them.
Yeah, the only comment that I will make is that the port has the money for our side. We either have it via reserves, we have it via operating cash flow, or our bonding capacity from our revenue stream that we have. We don't have to go out for GO bonds or get an approval or anything like that. So the port has its funds ready in the wings as soon as we get this other piece of the equation, vetted. Just so everyone knows, it's not about the port not having the money. We have the money, okay, to do what we need to do. All right. Okay, so with that, any other comments? Or if not, Vincent, you're up.
Super. Let me go.
Welcome and thank you.
I know that's probably tough. Let me get somebody on that side and then I'll get this here.
Yeah. Thank you.
On that side.
I'll share with you.
Vincent, would you prefer to
sit at the table here rather than standing up?
Well, I'm
get him a chair and he can sit at the table.
Chair there.
We need you at the table, Vincent.
Yeah, Vincent.
You can go wherever you like, sir.
And bring your checkbook.
Yeah, here you go.
Everybody got it.
Here.
Appreciate that.
There you go. Thank you.
Thank you. So.
Yes.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
I hope this helps your back.
Let me just start. Thank Chairman Campo and Executive Director Gunther and our commissioners today. And I prepared a few remarks here just to kind of get started. Many of you I know, many of you I don't, so I thought maybe just a little history on who I am and what I do and why I'm sitting here might be helpful. So I serve as the executive director for what we call the Coalition for Fair and Open Port. That's nighttime and weekends and spare moments in the day. But my professional career, I'm actually an officer with Targa Resources, which is a midstream company here in the Houston area and headquartered in Houston. Additionally to that, in a professional capacity, I serve as director on AOPL, which is the American Oil Pipeline Association. I'm also a director of ILTA, which is an International Liquids Terminal Association. Serve as a second vice president of, or vice chairman, excuse me, of the Greater Houston Port Bureau. And I'm also director of the Texas Pipeline Association, TPA. My wife and I raised three beautiful kids. All of them were born in Houston, Texas. Love this city, love this town. Have always tried to give back to our community. We moved out into Sugar Land. Giving back to the community has been a very, very important part of my life. I started many years ago, even as a writer and an organizer early on in the MS-150, the very first MS-150. I know I don't look like I can probably ride a bike today, but giving back has just been a very important part. We started Sugarland's Catholic Church, St. Lawrence Catholic Church and School out there, co-founded and led capital campaigns there and some high schools in the area as well. And then also acted as the original director and finally the chairman for the TIRS, the Tax Increment Reinvestment Zone, that is the hub of town center that brought in the Marriott Hotel in Sugar Land as well. So now I kind of found myself in a role as executive director of this coalition and kind of a broader sense, even with the Greater Houston Port Bureau. Today, really on a generational issue, something I think that is generational anyway. The implications that are unbelievable, the widening and kind of deepening of the ship channel. It underpins, as we all know, the strength of the entire community, the region, more broadly, the state of Texas, and really the strength and security of the United States, in my opinion. I've often referred to this as the carotid artery of America. You know, it seems like nobody cares about us until suddenly there's a disease and there's an issue and there's a crisis, and then they find out about Houston again, right? It's got to be one of the most underappreciated, if not the most underappreciated assets in America, in my opinion. So I'm going to share with you what I think to be a very thoughtful process of a plan to allow industry to participate in the funding on Project 11. And I would love to tell you that I brought my checkbook or that today I had 10, 11, 12, 15 different either companies or people today that were prepared to write $50 million or $25 million checks. I don't. I'm going to be up front and I'm going to tell you, I don't. That's not the presentation I have for you today. We looked at a number of different ways that industry can participate in this plan as we go forward. And the plan that we're outlining really was finally came to volition here just in the last few weeks and was kind of geared up to be presented back, as Roger said, we meet with the Big Ten once a week, and then it was to kind of broaden that out to a little bit larger group to the Greater Houston Port Bureau, and then I'm the speaker in the April Commerce Club luncheon, and I was going to go to a broader audience at that time after we continued to get feedback and refine this plan. So you saved me a lot of time, I guess, today by scheduling this meeting. So, you know, with that, I will tell you it's not a perfect plan, and we're here to not listen really to opposition, but proposition, or I am, and listen to the feedback and say, okay, how is it that there's a better methodology, and if you've got one, we want to know it, what would it be? Because we did spend a lot of time, and I'm going to walk through this in a second on how we got there. So, you know, while I'm no Jesse Jones, I would just tell you at the end of the day, I certainly look through Jesse Jones' eyes. I see the vision that he had over 100 years later. We have an asset here. We as an industry, and I'm passionate about it, want to participate. We want to find a way to participate. We want to be a part of it. There are legal boundaries on how and when and where you can have certain things done from an industry participation level and where things can get charged. And I'll walk through some of that as well. But we feel like we've got a plan which just mirrors and echoes basically the way fees and dollars are raised today. So let me just start down that path, if you will. And Roger touched on a bit of this, but some of the history. So since July 2019, Chairman Campo presented at a town hall to us kind of the outline of where things were going. And Roger presented sort of the beginnings, if you will, of what looked like Project 11. Analysis then began on a method of payments for industry's 50%. We looked at a management district. We did a look at LGC, a local government corporation. How could funds be raised through that? We spent time looking at other types of mechanisms and opportunities upon which could also be funded. The one strange issue with most public companies is that when they make an investment, they like to have a return back to their stockholders on it, and writing checks just simply into a trust fund or for a channel improvement is very difficult for, say, any of, you know, Shell Chemical, Kinder Morgan, Enterprise, Target, to be able to return back to their stockholders. So we've looked at other ways that we could fund this. We brought in outside counsel for this. We brought in a group that had been involved in fact, Chairman Campo with Houston First Masterson Group to do an analysis on how could we raise bonds, if you will, or go out with bonds and raise monies inside of a LGC or inside of a management district or inside of a separate company altogether that would be sort of a partnership company. And I'll be happy to get into more detail if questions come up later on that. But those really weren't an acceptable methodology. At the same time this is going on, we had asked the pilots, we, industry and the port together, had asked the pilots to please look at the simulation on what would the widening do and get that back to us, hopefully in time. And it was, the November date was the delivery date, and the pilots did that. And from that data, we were able to also go and model additional implications in terms of revenue generation at large for the industry and the shipping side, at least, that was coming in to the port. We didn't look at, say, what did it do in terms of additional land infrastructure and transportation, which we would assume would also grow with what was going on the shipping side. We back-tested that in December, and then on December 19th, as Roger, I think, alluded to, we had a meeting with stakeholders that were pretty broad, actually, beyond just the Big Ten or coalition folks and some of the Greater Houston Port Bureau members, banks, outside consultants, some that I named that were there, legal folks as well, to kind of look at these combined results and talk about next steps and where we had finally landed, which is this fee structure. January 2020, continue to have these meetings between the port and industry. Been out here several times with, again, the port staff and executive staff, Mr. Erickson. And moving forward through that entire process, along with the port, has been industry advocacy. So we've made over almost 100 meetings between Austin and Washington, D.C., either jointly or independently. I was there last week, as a matter of fact. Always talking off that same set of talking points that the port goes up with and that we've co-developed or developed with the port from last summer. Continuing to strike that beat, and in fact, my last slide, unfortunately, I get to the last slide and I talk about all of us have to also focus on the HMT, and I didn't know that I met with Babin last week twice, so I'm happy to know that we got $70 million back. That's outstanding. So industry advocacy, we're going to continue on. And regardless of whatever the questions, the outcome, how we move forward today, again, this is a draft. It's for discussion. I want you to know that industry is there. But I also want you to know that at the end of the day, I speak for a fairly narrow group of industry, but it's also the group that has most of the vessel traffic. And we're all over the board, whether it's 80, 90, 70, but it's certainly in excess of 70% of the vessel traffic that's in this fairly narrow group. As we get a little broader and we brush some of the other folks that are also in terms of our discussions, I know that we're not all properly aligned. We're not all on the same page, so I understand that. I use sort of the analogy that when you get on the toll road, one side has a Costco and the other side has a mom and pop hamburger place. And when you get on the toll road and I'm next to you and you're in your pickup and I'm in my pickup and we're going down the toll road and I pull off to go to Costco and you go to the hamburger place and we both paid the same toll, $2.50. The 18-wheeler pays a little more because it's bigger. It's not where we're necessarily going. It's that we all share because that's the social responsibility of what it costs to get on the toll road. So the concept is very similar to that as we walk through this. Again, it's imperfect. I'm not here to tell you it's decided. I will tell you, though, again, and this is not a refresher course necessarily, but I love looking at this picture, and I use this, and I stole this back from Chairman Campos' presentation, because I like having this when I go to D.C. I like having this to understand how many transits take place in this channel every day, and thank you to the pilots that do that. Thank you. I mean, it is an incredible, when you stand before some of the congressmen and legislators that have no clue how big Houston is, it is amazing to me. So I like this picture. I like being able to say we have 550 million barrels of storage for hydrocarbons and petrochemicals here in the Houston area. We have over 200,000 barge movements. We are a significant player when you look at us as against Long Beach, New York, New Jersey combined. So I throw that up. Growth, we know. Growth is happening. How do we move forward as an industry and participate in this? So regardless, it's growth by any measure, it's growth by every measure. You guys know this because I, again, took this. When we look at the significance of what the ship channel is, and I say this because I want you to hear back from industry what we hear from you, and that echo, that mirror is important, I think, that you understand the message gets to us, and we deliver that message also when we're in Washington. The number of jobs, how important it is to the state of Texas, and what does it mean to this economy? So if we looked at this on a go-forward basis, we said the best way to probably do this is to have a fee, okay? And so we did a deep dive on the ability to charge for the fees. And I saw your second agenda item, I believe, dives into this, and how do you look at this? And we provided the port with a fairly significant white paper that was done by our outside counsel on the legal methodology of with fees can be charged, and the conclusion was yes, they could be charged because we're already doing that with the security fee and the harbor, the fireboat fee, and then obviously the pilotage fee. So fees can be charged if they're reasonable, if they're used solely to pay for the cost of a service, if they enhance safety, efficiency. I think we'd all agree that widening and deepening the ship channel does that for both interstate and foreign traffic. And if they don't impose more than a small burden, whether it's interstate or foreign, and I don't think you'll see in the way we've looked at this, it does. When we look at key assumptions, $1 billion, we've heard that's over 4 to 5 years. The fees would finance 50%, Project 11 on the ship channel. Fees cannot be collected, though, in advance of the project completion. And we know that's a key issue. If you're borrowing, if you're going to borrow to build a building, and certainly Mr. Campo, Chairman Campo knows this as good as anybody, you have a construction loan that generally converts to a mortgage on the building. So we've got a 4-year gap or 5-year gap before fees can actually start to be collected. I just put that out there because we are aware of that. And we've looked at issuance of $500 million over 30 years. We put a coupon rate on it, 4%, some interest on it. And we know that then the end result is you got about $1.1 billion that has to be paid. And I apologize for the small print on the next page. So you look at the revenue, and we said, okay, if you look at revenue that's earned from each transit in the ship channel, let's take the same approach that the pilots had taken, which was the vessel LOA and beam, and see how could we model something that is deliberately off of that. So it mirrors an existing fee structure that currently are used by the Houston pilots. So from a legal standpoint, we feel that also underpins the legal premise. It's an ease of implementation, ease of collection, ease of administration. Everyone participates that currently is on the channel because it would be on a vessel by vessel charge. Okay? And it's equitable. We think it gets the most benefit and the greatest contribution. If you look at that, and there's a model that we put together, so it's LOA times beam. We created what we call the vessel unit, and that simply was a multiplier in effect. So I'll walk you to the next page really to look at it, but if you just took it down and said, okay, you had a 700-foot vessel, 106-foot beam under step one, that's 742 vessel units. And we have a dollar unit factor that we created based on the algorithm. And that basically would be $2,200 per transit that would be paid to fund the project on this 742-foot vessel. I will tell you, based on some of the companies that we went out, our companies, for instance, at Target, and we asked, would this affect you in coming to Houston, Texas? They very quickly smiled and said, no way. It's an insignificant charge. It's a rounding error. It wouldn't be important to us. We asked other companies that called on other ports. I realize that's not going to be the message. I understand that from every shipper, every vessel. I got that. But I will tell you, at least on a touch point of the ones we asked, would that be an impact? Would that drive you to another port? The answer was no. Again, I'm all ears and I'm open for feedback, and I won't point to anyone in the room, but a couple folks have burned my ears already with it would be important to them. So I do understand there is some opposing opinions to what I just told you. Okay. If we look at how we came up with key assumptions on the vessel, we took the harbor light data. I mentioned that we back tested. A bunch of information that came to us from harbor lights. We took every vessel, I'll say that, I'm pausing, think about that. From 2017 and 2018, we loaded that data into an outside source called Cirrus, a consulting group out of London, that modeled Stockholm and Singapore and a number of other ports around the world, and we back tested every movement. So if that vessel, an individual vessel, made a stop 20 times, like a chemical vessel might, we modeled that in our movement modeling, if you will. Every vessel movement was back tested, and that was in our Cirrus model. That was from the harbor lights dated for 2017 and 18. On the 2019 data that's just been finished collecting, we'll throw that back in as well, but basically, I'm sure many of you have seen the harbor lights data that came out for 2019. It was pretty flat to 2018 or 20. It was a little up from 17, but pretty flat to 2018. So I don't know that we'll see a lot of difference. We put in some growth assumptions of about 0.5% annual growth across all the vessel types. We took out inland barges and tugs because they're not available in there. And in that model, but we did put about $25 on a collection of about 250 or 25,000 barges. with some growth. And those barges are really more the ATB type barges that are articulated barges, as opposed to the inland barges, the brown water barges. We're not talking about those, just for clarity's sake. So the vessel categories are at the bottom. You can kind of look at them. If you go to the next page, you'll see 16,102 transits. And you may say, well, Vincent, you told us there were almost 19,000. And the answer is that's correct, because as Chairman Campo and Roger have said, the balance sheet of the port is structured around the container traffic. And so all of the containers are out of this number. The containers aren't paying twice, if you will, okay? Because in essence, they're already paying for the other $500 million, just to be clear, okay? And I think that's fair to all parties. So the containers are out, and any shift, so if you have a vessel that came in, and your Exxon Chemical, let's say, or your Shell, or your Oxy, and that chemical ship has made 10 stops, those ships didn't take, you're not getting charged for those ships inside, okay? So the ships are out, and the containers are excluded from this. And so when you look on the right-hand box, you'll see kind of per vessel, what has to be collected per vessel. You'll note that, again, the larger vessels obviously are collecting, we're collecting more revenue on the larger vessels, and the contribution by vessels, you'll see oil tankers, chem tankers, LPGs. The bulk of the tankers make up the biggest part of this. So when we say, again, industry's paying, just to be clear, industry's paying via these, the vessel count and the vessel chartering that we charter. The last page is sort of the up and to the right, and the significance of this is really simple, that the larger vessels pay the largest amounts. Largest vessels typically in the port have been the petrochemical and the oil tankers and LPG tankers. They haven't been the smaller vessels that are delivering to the city docks, let's say, or elsewhere. And again, we've excluded anything that would be a container. So that is the model that we've come up with. The query is, of course, how do we raise the $500 million? So we looked out at these LGCs. We looked at the opportunity for management districts. Masterson, who I mentioned, came back to us at a meeting and said, look, if you did any of these things, the problem would be, as an association, a group, a coalition going out for debt, you're not going to be able to raise $150 million or $200 million, much less $500 million. And before the ahs and the oohs come, I'll just tell you. So the answer was, the best balance sheet is the best balance sheet, and that is the ports. And they said, inquire if the port would do two tranches. Would they do a $500 million tranche secured by the container side? And would they do a $500 million tranche that industry would secure with these fees? And that's where we are today. That's what I discussed with Roger and group a month or so ago, 2 months ago, a month and a half ago. And as we've collectively tried to vet that out, I know it meets with resistance on various fronts, and I understand that. I'm open to tell you that industry wants to participate, help us with a model that's different than that, that gets us there. We went out to bond underwriters. I know there's some bankers in the room, and they certainly would understand this as good as anybody. And when you look at a new entity and say, I want to raise $500 million in this entity, and here's the fee structure for that, you're a quadruple minus F credit rating. You're not, you're a non-existing entity today, and you're going to form it tomorrow secured by these fees. And although these fees that are coming in are certainly predictable, we feel like they've been coming in for 100 plus years, and the growth is significant, and we can model that, it's just something that we did not get success when we went to the bond rating group. So as I say, the consultants that we've used, which are the same ones that were outside agents for and consultants for other entities, came back and said, look, talk to the port about doing it under their balance sheet. So that is where we are today. I would end and take questions. Really, I'll tell you, again, industry is incredibly supportive. We want to participate. The LPP plan is the only plan that works for Houston. Chairman Campbell and I were on the phone yesterday. You know, because the issue is, if this doesn't work, where do we go? Do we go back to the plan, which is in essence the 15-year plan or the 20-year plan, because you do it under the cycles of the federal government and the allocation under the Corps? I will tell you that that's detrimental for everybody in the room. That doesn't work for any of us. The LPP, the expedited plan is the plan that we need, and to not expedite the widening and deepening threatens the existence really of not only the Port of Houston. I believe that it really is detrimental to Harris County, the state of Texas, when we look at the entire region. We all know that there's lots of changes in the winds in a lot of ways over the next 30 years or so, and we in Houston need to take advantage of those changes today. Houston is the gateway to the world currently for the U.S., and I'm passionate. I want it to remain that way. My last comment, you know, we have to work together to get every dollar paid into the HMT return to Houston. I couldn't be happier to hear the $70 million. So with that, I am more than happy, Chairman, to take questions, dig into weeds. I don't, you know, lead me on wherever you'd like to get.
So we'll take questions from the commissioners. Go ahead, Mr. Fitzgerald.
Vincent.
Yes, sir.
You mentioned that the containers were exempt, right?
Yes, sir.
And you said because they contribute into the port's revenues, who's doing this other part of the funding? What about these vessels sitting right out here? This one and outside, it contributes also to the port's revenues, but you're not excluding them. Is that right?
I believe, help me on that, Brad, did we not include all city dock, all vessels to city docks? Just containers.
It doesn't say that.
Then I stand for
it. It's just 19%
contributed. It was just containers.
Just containers.
We could model that and we could look at that. Yeah. I don't know the significance.
Well, I just want to make sure that I understood that correctly.
Yeah, it was just containers. Okay.
So the barge, that's where it says barge, 1387, is that an ATB?
Yeah, those are the ATBs that are coming from Blue Water.
An inland towboat and barge?
And I'd have to look at Bill Dill, but the qualifier for that is if it comes in via these and it's cracked on the harbor lights, so if it's a pilot each, then inland towboats, that may be a qualifier, but it's a barge, ATB-type barge.
But it requires a pilotage. Mm-hmm. And these fees are one is for in and out.
In and out. Well, pardon me. When you say in and out, there's a fee. This fee is duplicated, so it's a fee. If it's $2,000, it's $2,000 in, $2,000 out. So it'd be $4,000 on that big ship. $2,200, $4,000.
So the ATB.
So for instance, on our ships, I have David Clark who's. With me behind me, but I believe on our ships that are 750 to about 850, the average that, just to give you an indicator why that number is from a sensitivity level, when I said we went out to our customers, they're paying right now about $25,000 for a vessel to get to my docks today. I don't know if you're aware of that. That's between pilotages and other fees today. So when they looked at that and put that on, although they're not really all excited about paying another, say, $4,000 to come into the Houston port, it wasn't as significant as some of the other fees they're paying, just to give you kind of order of magnitude.
Thank you.
So my question kind of ties into that. So basically, when you stack on this fee, they're now up to around 30 grand in fees that they're paying?
Correct. For our ships that come into my dock, yes, they're going to be high 20s at least, yes, sir.
And on the other ships that are coming into, that Clyde referred to, that come into the city docks, have you talked to those?
I would tell you that I think what we'll do is we'll go back and relook at carving those out a little bit. I don't think those are going to move the needle a whole lot in terms of everybody else collecting. Because, again, I think that we need to look at what the port collects at Al and carve all that out would be my belief.
Yeah.
Just, you know, and again, I need to talk to the rest of my group, but I think that was our intention was to, you know, the containers obviously were the big bulk of the vessels coming inbound.
And then my other question would be in terms of on the sale, if we sold bonds, whether they be revenue or GO bonds that are issued by the port, would the coalition companies have a interest in purchasing those bonds?
Well, that's a great question. We actually asked that to our bankers to kind of look at that kind of investment And then we've kind of talked to some of the treasurers and some of the companies about that. I don't have a yes or no or thumbs up or down on that. I know it's, we actually have initiated that very thought process.
Because I would imagine that would be tax-wise advantageous to,
yeah,
to companies like yours and in the other companies.
Yeah, I certainly think we have some interest, whether it be at the corporate level or at the, let me say, membership of directors and other folks in the companies that would be interested in it. I can't tell you thumbs up or down. I'm not,
okay.
Again, it was something we have just really recently discussed at one of the meetings.
Okay.
Just so I can understand the nuts and bolts of what you're saying. So the proposal is for the port to issue some sort of bonds in the amount of $500 million.
Yes, sir.
Is that correct? And then who would collect these fees?
They would roll exactly the way today, the pilotage fees. We'd exactly use the same mechanism. They would collect through the methodology the pilotage fees come in is the way I would phrase it, and the port would collect the fees.
Okay, so I guess I've got several concerns with the proposal. One is, if when the port issues an obligation, basically we're putting the port's credit on the line.
Yes, sir.
And if by heaven forbid bankruptcy or some, if these fees go uncollected, then somebody's got to make up the difference. And I'm not saying that would ever happen, but ultimately, the way I interpret this, you're asking the port basically to, in effect, take the risk for the coalition's portion of the project. And I don't even know if this is doable, or would the coalition members be willing to sign a guarantee that these funds would be available? Because we would have really, as a port, very little way to enforce the collection of the fees. In other words, we're not going to go out and stop.
It would be much I would suggest, because we went down this path a little bit in some prior meetings. I would suggest back to you that you do have a way to enforce it, because you just don't, the vessel doesn't move. So it's much like the way the fireboat, which is collected today, on every vessel that moves in. So, and the fee is collected basically almost at the time. So it's not in arrears necessarily. So it's not a year later we're trying to collect. So in essence to that. So I think it's a fairly real-time fee collection, and the vessel doesn't move if the fee's not paid. So.
But any downturn, I'm having a hard time getting.
There is a risk shift. I agree with you, Commissioner. I'm not sidestepping that. There's a risk shift. And which is the very reason that the consultant said, look, the best balance sheet is the best balance sheet, and that is the ports. The risk shift is if there is some change that's dynamic, a paradigm shift in either hydrocarbons moving or resins moving or some other commodity moving or even wind blades moving in and out, right?
Right.
If there's a shift, something that is a still, the pipes, whatever, I understand that. And that is one of the reasons we tempered. You have seen many of our models, I think, over the years, certainly over the last couple of years, that show a nice spike on the Permian production, certainly when we talk about oil and we talk about LPGs, ethylene, gas exports. We've tempered this with that growth. We didn't put in these nice step-ups in growth for that very reason. We'll be happy to come back to this group on a smaller group and model sensitivities where we take 15% off or 10% off, and look at what that does. I think, I'll look around the room, but I think we'd be hard pressed in our sense to believe that there'd be more than a 10% decline in traffic. We've seen a pretty good way for us to adapt to downturns, whether it's industrial downturns or whether it's been oil and gas downturns. But to your point, certainly more than willing to look at sensitivities around that.
Well, and you understand, I guess, our sensitivity to the fact that throughout this process, the coalition has steadfastly represented that they will produce $500 million, half the cost of the project. I guess I'm a little disappointed that the proposal at this point is that, in effect, the port funded and the entire project and get paid back over time through customers. And I understand the process that y'all went through. I just give you an anecdotal situation. We had a situation in Baytown where Chevron Phillips was doing the ethane cracker project, and they needed Sholander Road to be expanded from two lanes to five lanes to facilitate getting 8,000 workers in and out of the project. Chevron worked with the city when I was mayor out there to fund the project, and they funded the project because it was an investment in their infrastructure. It was necessary for that project. And we worked out a method by which they eventually got repaid 80% of their investment through reduction in industrial district rates over a number of years. But it was the industry that fronted the money and put in 20% of the cost of that infrastructure, and they got it done in a 6-month period that highway was built. So I think there are ways in which this cat can be skinned. I'll apologize to PETA, but that this project can be funded in such a way that doesn't put the port at risk and doesn't put us putting up $500 million in bonds. So that's I'm looking at perhaps a more creative way that takes some of the burden off of the port. I mean, we're doing our part.
Right. I would tell you yesterday, Chairman Camp and I had a conversation, and I said, look, there is no doubt that if we had more time and I had nothing else to do, that I think, and your example is very good because you had a single entity, CP Chem, okay, with a single very important, okay, project for them, right? That if I had more time, and as I say, and I mean this seriously, and it was the only thing I had to do because I really do believe in this as a generational project. This is something, it's one of those rare moments. You can make a change that's good for, you know, 30, 50 years, right? That I could get something like that done. I could actually get enough people to sign up and agree to do things over time. We're short on time. WARDA is in February 27th. It's going to go to committee. The chief's report is coming out, and we're at the point we've got, and I understand, we've got to figure it out. Also, want to not step away from your opening remark. I understand from many of you, several of you, the disappointment based on what you heard that you don't see people writing checks. I understand that. You don't see corporations writing checks. I understand that. I accept that. What I want to do is to tell you that we also, though, fully support this project and we're behind it, and we need to figure out a way to get it funded.
Agreed.
Well, I have one. Vince, one other question. You mentioned also a while ago about the economic benefit that everybody enjoys. Harris County, the city, the state. Have you ever thought about going to the state as your group and soliciting some funding from them? There's other states that give a substantial amount of funding to their ports because of the economic benefit. I think your group would be very strong going to Austin, and we've got some rainy day money there. What's better to spend rainy day money than creating more jobs in this port?
We have not done that. I certainly, again, from a timing perspective, I'd be happy next time that I was just in Austin as well last week and would have been happy to address that. State, obviously, as the godfather over many ports,
right?
You know, has their issues too, but that's a viable option.
Well, they can give all the ports a little money and still be okay, right? But we don't need that much, just a little bit.
Go ahead, Dean.
Just so I'm clear, Vincent.
Yes, sir.
So on the barges, the ATBs, so what would trigger piloted, I mean, what would trigger the fee would be piloted, correct?
Yeah, right.
Well, my concern on that is most of these ATBs are coastwise transits,
right?
And Captain Thompson can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe
Do they come in unattended?
They don't necessarily need a state pilot. And okay. I would hate to see us create an incentive, financial incentive, not to use a pilot. Because I think state pilots are by far the safest route that we could use. And I don't know if anybody thought about that, but that's a concern.
Okay. Again, those are things we'll take and adjust in the model.
And I agree with Commissioner Don Carlos on the risk. I'm not, you know, it's a big issue, but I guess you mentioned you had Coke or council that was helping you go through. And has anyone done harbor fees before? And what do those legal challenges look like? What has come up? I mean, before we even get into.
Yeah, I mean, I know you're going to talk about that in your executive session, but the answer is yes, they've done harbor fees. Yes, there hasn't been hardly any legal challenges to them. There are a number of places that can be cited, and there is a memo that we shared with the port. Mm-hmm. They may share with you in executive session. Mr. Erickson has a copy of it as well. We were kind of sensitive to the exposure of it, but yes, and
okay.
Yeah.
I read through it. I just
okay.
Not completely comfortable, but
okay.
Okay, Eric, you might give us some background on the discussion you've had about the legal issues.
Sure, and happy to do that. Okay. Just a little history first. There are some, as your counsel pointed out too, there are some constitutional constraints on these kind of fees. And so about 34 years ago, Congress, when it passed 186, put in place a system the system was probably there already, but not in federal law, but sort of tried to organize under federal law the way fees could be passed. And as Vincent mentioned, there's a provision for service fees. So I just happen to have this in front of me. So that's it. For those who like to look at statutes, it's 33 U.S. Code annotated Section 5. And so basically it allows fair and equitable fees that can be used for services and safety, as Vincent mentioned, and put small burden. Those are service fees. And so the crux of the coalition's analysis, as I see it, and the memo I think makes this pretty clear, is the fee as proposed by the coalition is being analogized to a service fee. And you mentioned that it's similar to the fee that the port has had for almost 50 years for fire protection. And we collect $7 million a year roughly on that, and then that's used for our fire boats. People know about the fire boats. We have our fire stations. And
we have any issues with collection of that fee?
Not really, but what's the fee per transit?
$600.
So that's that fee. I mean, we do have some, you know, we do have some collection issues, as you would when you're collecting anything.
Yeah, but it's not material.
But that's fine. So the analogy that the coalition has used to that. The primary question I think that we still need to answer is that same word of 86 also said that you can charge fees under another section of federal law, 2236. And that is for financing, construction, and operation of a navigation project. And my concern, and we've talked about this, is would this fee be looked at by the courts as a service fee? In which case it can be basically you can charge what the worth of the service is, or is it going to be looked at as a fee under this 2236? And if it's under 2236, then we've got some concerns. And again, we've talked about this. If you're just looking under 2236, if it's a fee associated with the cost of deepening, then you can only charge vessels that now can transit and couldn't transit before. And if it's a fee associated with the cost of widening, then it has to be, and that just to use the verbiage, vessels comparable in size used to those to justify the widening. And then there are some exclusions, and you basically talked about the exclusions. Right. Interport shifts and vessels less than 20 feet in draft, et cetera. So I think the biggest concern that we need to make sure for this fee is we need to, and there are no cases on this. So this is just going to be the best judgment. And candidly, if we issue bonds, as those who have worked with finance attorneys and financiers, they're going to look very closely at this too, because that's going to be a key element. The question really will be, is this fee going to be looked at as a service fee, and therefore it's going to pass muster, or is it going to be looked at as one under this other provision where you really have some constraints, whether it's a widening or it's a deepening? And if it is under 2236, I think then we have to say, do we, when you're doing your sensitivity, and maybe we just need to do this anyway, if one of the sensitivity analysis has to be the fee can only be this more limited fee under 2236, and if that's the case, there's one other requirement too, and it's an obvious one, I think, to everybody. It has to be commensurate with the benefit. And so we would have to say, okay, this is the universe of vessels we're going to charge, and then this is the fee that's commensurate to the benefit, and then the question is, what kind of financing can you raise with that kind of fee amount? And so I think those are the questions that I think we still need to work through when we're doing it. And we've talked about this before. And so I think the presentation is a fee based on a service model. Mm-hmm. And we just need to make sure that would be the model that is going to be looked at. Because another thing about 2236, it actually has a requirement. We're going to have to go, and again, we talked about this, there's going to be a public hearing requirement. We have to file it with the feds. And then there's an opportunity, and it's not a big window, which is nice, but there's a window for a court challenge before it's imposed. So all of those sort of steps would have to be taken. So again, part of the due diligence that we need to continue to do, in my mind, is just looking at all those issues.
I guess you were saying the previous time there was an issuance of they've done harbor fees was under, it was looked at as a service fee?
It's been looked at as a service fee, correct. There hasn't been a challenge, as
right. And that's a good, that's a good factor. But my understanding also is they're more at the level of dollars that are service fee, right, or one that's inarguably the service fee, which is the one for fire. So, and again, that's part, and I hate to sound like a lawyer, but part of the risk analysis, if it's a small fee, is it going to be challenged as opposed to if it's a bigger fee? That's just, again, we need to think about it, because at the end of the day, as it's been modeled, it's our credit that we have to think about. And that's obviously, this project is extremely important. And obviously providing our credit towards is something we've already said to do. If this other fee on top of it impaired the ability to do this project from that standpoint, that would be a significant thing we need to think
about. So summarizing your answer, it could be legal and proper in a certain construct, but it's complicated. We have to focus on issues associated with who's bearing the risk.
I don't get paid by the word either. So,
but I said anyway. Well, if you did, you'd be rich.
I'm here.
He's blushing. Okay. Other questions? So I do have a couple. So Vincent,
may I ask a question from the floor, please?
Oh, in a second.
Okay.
When we're finished with our commission, we'll go ahead and let people speak. So would you help me understand? You mentioned that if you had more time, you could come up with something more interesting, perhaps, or connected to the discussion that we've had in the past. So, based on the fourth quarter earnings or in the 2019 earnings of most of the coalition folks, especially midstream folks, they had pretty good years and some record years. When we started out having this discussion in 2019 in July, the big issue was have to have the modeling from the pilot so we can actually put the increased throughput into a model and figure out how much cash flow we're going to be able to, that industry participants were going to be able to generate in addition to what they would have if you have a wider channel, correct?
Correct.
And we got that information, and my understanding is that is that each company looked at it, and by and large, the throughput was significantly increased, and therefore their cash flow would be increased as a direct result of it. And then, of course, when you take the models that have been that the coalition has shown multiple times to lots of people, including us and legislatures and others, the curve, or at least the far and to the right growth of hydrocarbon exports and crude exports are supposed to crude is supposed to double in the next 5 years, and I think we're the number one exporter of propane in the world, and that's going to continue to grow. I guess I help me with why there's a disconnect between increased cash flow, increased throughput with companies that are doing really well, and why they can't write checks.
I would tell you that the answer is not as easy as just they won't write checks.
It's okay.
That when they make an investment, which would be an investment in the ship channel, the answer back is what's the return on that investment? And it's difficult for them to look at that and say, I'm going to make an investment in the ship channel, and on my investment in the ship channel is worth X.
But I guess I don't understand that, because if the issue was the industry needed the pilot's analysis that said, right, by 2024 you're going to have this ability to have drive throughput, and that was going to increase cash flow, and if you didn't do that by 2024, you're talking 2030, 2032, then cash flows have to go down, or you aren't be able to capture that value if you don't.
Correct.
If we don't widen the channel sooner. So I don't understand why that can't, why the industry isn't looking at that as their numerator, the incremental right. increase in right. cash flow from 2024 to 2030, and the denominator being the check they write in order to create a rate of return for their shareholders. That part I don't understand. Are we not as confident about throughput, or is it because you should be able to calculate return on investment on those numbers, right?
Under the algorithm you just gave me, yes, that would right. you would calculate a return on that investment. However, when you look at that investment, that's a one-to-one correlation. You're saying I put that dollar in, and so my curve is automatically. You don't automatically know that every dollar you put in is allocated back for your growth. So what they're looking at, or our treasurers are looking at, or our investment committees look at, is okay, if we put X amount of dollars into a fund, and yes, our curve goes up, do we because of that fund get a return on that dollar, or is it proportional to the dollars that we put in the fund, right? So it's not always a 1-1, but your algorithm based on the numerator concept of yes, you have a growth curve. I don't deny that, yes. So why won't they write a check? They're looking at allocation of dollars and saying, hey, what's the best investment and how do I get a return, and where can I calculate that return and know what that return is?
Okay, so then the other question I have is, so tell me about, walk me through, if a fee is charged, $4,000 for a large ship, call it, or something like that for in and out. So how does that, the shipping company, relate to that fee to the customer? You are chartering those, your target is chartering your ships, correct?
Everybody.
How does that pass through? Is the industry ultimately paying that fee by virtue of having to pay a higher price for that? For ship to take your products out?
That is going to be different. Every company is going to have a different skew on that, because it depends if they charter the ship themselves, is it their commodity on the ship, are they the end user of that in another country, are they bringing it in for a feedstock supply? So that is really a multiplicity.
So it's not a direct connection to the customer. So yeah. You may pay, the shipping company may have to absorb the cost passing it on to the customer at the dock level,
could be
Argo or whoever. Okay.
Right. Could be any of those things.
All right. The other question, so did the coalition model, this is to, I believe it's to a little bit more detail of Commissioner Branch's question, which is on a competitive basis, when we think about pilotage and we think about just the cost of coming in, that $25,000 number that you kind of threw out, how is that? Did the coalition do some analysis of other competitive ports on how does Port of Houston stack up from a pure competitive perspective on the cost of ingress, egress, and what has to happen in our channel relative to other channels? Because one of the things that I've learned over the last year-ish of being involved in this is that cargo and products they flow like water. They flow to the path of least resistance and to the easiest and cheapest mechanism to get their product from point A to point B. And if we become less competitive as a port because we're charging fees, does that overall push business somewhere else and potentially hurt, you know, our consumers in Harris County and jobs?
Right. You've got about 8 questions in there, but let me see if I can
work competitive.
What can I mark down the list for you?
Yeah.
Let me go down the list. So, first and foremost, because of you said, does higher fees push people to other ports? Again, I would tell you, in the sphere that I operate in the oil and gas petrochemical sphere, because of the infrastructure that Houston has, it's very difficult for somebody to have an alternative to the Port of Houston. When you look at the hundreds of billions of dollars of infrastructure that we're fortunate enough to have here and the incremental 100+ billion dollars that's being built right now, it's very difficult for somebody to just yank themselves out of here. Other commodities, I understand, it may be easier to go to Mobile or New Orleans or Corpus or Freeport. I do appreciate that, and I think that's why we've tried to be sensitive to both ship size and also, what docks were they going to, if you will. When you also look at the counterpoint to not doing the widening and deepening, it affects everybody. So at that point, we're chasing everybody out of the house, so to speak. It's not just what is happening in terms of the soft goods or oil and gas or cotton or cattle. It's everybody starts to look at, because you're going to find even the large petrochemical companies and other folks will say, hey, you know what, we've got 55 feet of water at, you know, X place, or we've got an ability to pipe from here to, you know, Lake Charles or somewhere. And, laying pipe is cheaper than doing something else. So everybody starts to look at, you know, what are alternatives if we don't widen and deepen.
So it is a risk. Well, the issue of widening and deepening, we're going to do it.
Yeah.
There's no question. Yeah. The question is timing, right?
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, when you look at the port has a very strong balance sheet and a very strong cash flow, but if you leverage it all and take the risk that you're going to, and you do that all now, it puts the port in a very perilous financial condition if in fact the you do have a downturn in the economy. And you know, we've had the longest recovery in U.S. history now, and yes, interest rates are lower for longer, but you know, we need to prepare for the downturn, and we don't need to leverage our balance sheet to the point where we could be in trouble financially if you have an economic downturn, especially when you think about what's going on with the coronavirus and energy prices and all that. Sure. Obviously, so you know, that's part of the issue, right? It's not about, are we going to widen? It's for sure we're going to widen and deepen. The question is it 6 years early or not? And how does that affect jobs? And how does that affect energy company earnings and midstream companies and what have you? Obviously, we're not debating that. Obviously, we're obviously just debating how do we pay for it and how do we get there from here. I guess the other sort of last point that I'd like you to kind of talk about, you talked about needing more time. So I know we have our PPA we have to sign when word gets completed. So what would you do differently with the time? Just focus on different mechanisms?
I think we'd look at, we would continue to look at multiple mechanisms. One of the things that we did look at in terms of like that management district, mm-hmm. that requires a couple of years, and as you know better than I, that requires a state. Mm-hmm. There's things like that that might have been good because it gets broader and more regional, and so the brunt, if you will, is a little broader to be able to do that and raise the bonds and offset it with fees, or raise the bonds and do something differently. So the mechanisms we would probably have taken maybe a little deeper dive, or would take a little deeper dive in.
Okay. Any other questions from commissioners?
No.
No, I would just say that, I think we're all committed to getting this done within the shorter timeframe versus the longer timeframe. But I think it's very important, you know, how we do it. And as the chairman said, you know, we don't leverage up our balance sheet that would, you know, ultimately stifle our growth on a go-forward basis, as we have additional capital projects that we have to take on to maintain our competitiveness in the market.
Mm-hmm. I understand that and appreciate that very much.
I just have a quick question, I guess, of Roger. This project can be done in phases, is that correct? In other words, we could go with what we can fund reasonably and do portions that directly affect the port.
With the funds that we have.
With the funds that we have and can obtain, and then other phases could be done later on in the normal process.
Absolutely can be done in phases. Certain phases may go together, but
Roger, does the whole thing have to be approved and funding put aside before they are going to allow us to say, okay, go? I mean, I understand it can be done in phases, but don't we have to show them we have the money to get the approval?
You have to have authorization. Then you have to sign a contract with a PPA that talks about how the contract's going to be executed. Yes.
You have to show a plan. Yeah. And if our plan is 2024, you have to, what I kind of call, put up or shut up.
That's right.
Right? So you got to show how you're going to do it.
A phase of it could be pulled up and go forward. I mean, I guess I was under the understanding that we had to have a commitment for the whole thing to get the approval to get started, even to do a section we might pull out.
Yes. I mean, short answer is yes. I mean, keep in mind, this is a contract that we signed that we're financially obligated to construct.
And remember, the construction by 2024 is having the capital to do it in that time frame. And ultimately what happens is you're able to do it faster because you're not waiting on appropriations and normal government process, which takes 10 years to get, right?
But could you do the first phase that we're going to finance it through the port and whatever phases 1A through C?
I personally think,
and then the second part, then we're proposing that you go.
I know what you're talking about. I think the challenge with that is that you're bifurcating the project, and the Corps has heard the discussion with industry, as has Congress and all the other players that we're playing with, and you're talking about changing the PPA strategy that we're doing, and it's a big issue. And so to me, I think they're looking for how are you going to do the project fundamentally? If you want it faster, you have to do a PPA that has the whole thing funded that way. And so, yeah, we could change our mind now and say, okay, let's think if we can do it another way. But I think you just throw a risk into the project that we may or may not be able to do that. And so I think those are debates we need to have in the future, but I don't think we know the exact answer to that. But I think I know the reaction from some of the folks that we spent a lot of time talking to about in Washington and through with the Corps and others about how this is going to get done. We'd have to do a complete about face.
The coalition would have
to. Well, the federal, we're the non-federal sponsor. And when we go to Washington, D.C., we're talking as a non-federal sponsor. How we get our money, they don't really care about. They really don't. And whether it's port, whether it's fees, whether it's coalition or people writing checks, they're just looking at us, not at anybody else. So if we say, well, we don't have our plan together, that is a bad message to send to the folks across the board. So that's not a message we're going to send at this point. So because I think we can work through this, hopefully. So with that said, any other questions from?
Have you guys looked at the phasing and how it would affect your business, in essence, if we phased it out over a longer period of time?
No.
You haven't modeled that as
to. No, we've assumed the same. We've followed exactly the same model.
I don't understand that because if everyone was waiting for the pilots to tell them how much throughput they could have in 2024 versus 2030,
right?
then there was math done that says, you know, throughput increases pretty dramatically.
Oh, we know the gap. I'm sorry.
Maybe
maybe I didn't understand the question. I thought he was asking me something different about.
Well, I mean, so when you look at that number, then the question ultimately becomes, if you say, well, if you guys only do, you know, two phases, then we can't get to our numbers where we need.
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. Yes. Yeah. You're right. We know what we termed it at risk. We know we do know the at risk volumes, that are out there. If the phases took, say, to 20, 30 or 35. Yes.
But so have you looked at in terms of, if we go the route of we're only going to do three phases,
we haven't bifurcated sort of a step change, but we could go back in and look at that where we've only looked at years one to three, let's say, and then there's a step change, and the rest of it takes 7 years is what I kind of a balloon is what you're suggesting.
Yeah,
we didn't run a model that particular. We could, we didn't. Okay.
And we haven't either.
And we haven't either.
Yes. And our advocacy is about not using the business as usual plan, and using a Jesse Jones plan.
Yeah. No, okay? I think we're all in agreement. Right. We want to get it done.
Right. I understand. And so we haven't spent a lot of time taking it apart and saying, what if we do this? What if we do that? How much we can. You know, and I don't think we need to do that at this point. I think it would be very counterproductive and to our messaging to all of the constituents involved in the process. So, with that said, any other questions?
One more. Vince, how much longer do you think it would be before y'all get a final proposal? You said yourself that some of these things y'all could go back and talk about. How much longer before you can walk in here and say, this is the best we can do, this is it?
Well, again, the timeline that we were kind of walking through here was to kind of go through the rest of the Big Ten, 12, whatever, Big Ten 12, have that discussion, broader discussion among the Greater Houston Port Bureau, because that's a much broader group, take that, and then, again, I was going to have a much broader discussion, or at least a kind of a bigger presentation that would then have been refined by April, so I would tell you end of April.
Okay. All right, let's go move on to public comment. I know we have some people that, remember, you got 3 minutes, unless there's do we have anybody sign up, or are we just going to call on people? Yeah. Go ahead and please state your name and who you're.
Chairman Kemper, commissioners, thank you very much. To those who don't know me in the room, my name's Gareth Williams. I work for a Norwegian shipping company, Odfjell Tankers. We have approximately 140 vessel calls into Houston, and I think if I pluck a number out of thin air, roughly 4 million tons of product we ship into and out of the area. I'm very fortunate to be part of the Big Ten, as well as to work closely with the Greater Houston Port Bureau. And as I stand before you today, I absolutely underline, as a ship owner, that the most important project that faces us today is the widening of the Houston Ship Channel. It's a vital artery to the world markets. It's how we as carriers keep US Inc. competitive on the world stage. So we absolutely support that 100%. My observations, I think, from the discussion around here today are, when we look at the cost of this, who are the direct beneficiaries? And comments have been made by Vincent that this is an industry issue, and that industry owns the ship channel as that vital artery to the world markets. And I guess my comment and slight concern as we look at the funding mechanisms is, how do we allocate that cost to the direct beneficiaries? I have no problem with the issue of paying a fee. I have a bigger issue with how we effectively charge that back to the direct beneficiaries. Chairman Kemper, you've touched on that in your questioning with Vincent, and I think there were some excellent points there. Thank you very much. It leads me to wonder, is there a different mechanism here by which we charge that, whether it's throughput, whether it's that fee goes directly back to the customer that's involved, just so that it isn't automatically picked up by the ship owners? Because I think that in the case of what we do, and please remember, we may call we may call 8 docks. I think that we would, under this model, have to pay 8 fees in and out. Does it.
If you go back to the
call. I think it's excluded. The shifts are excluded.
Yeah, any interim movements are excluded.
They are now. So it's just one in, one out.
Yeah.
Okay. But if we can find a mechanism that places that cost fairly back with the, thank you, with the direct beneficiaries, that would be something I'd be very keen to explore.
So let me ask you a question along those lines. So some of the folks that hire your ships to move their tonnage, how is that fee calculated? So, and how would a fee like this be passed on to a customer?
In short, we're not a cost-plus model. We have to arrive at an overall freight number that's all-inclusive.
Okay.
We would love to be able to separate that out, but that's proved to be very difficult because of the number of cargoes that we carry that everybody wants to share, so on and so forth. So it doesn't make it easy for us to price that directly.
So in a competitive market, you just load in all of your cost and you make a bid on a ship.
Yes.
And if somebody else is bidding against you and they're willing to take a lower margin, then you'll lose the business and they'll get the business. Yes. So that $4,000, they'll go into the equation.
It's blown on the way.
Ultimately gets passed to the customer or eaten by the shipper if, in fact, you want to be more competitive than your competition.
That's correct.
Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Any other questions, commissioners? Thank you so much, Garrett.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Anybody else? Yes, sir.
Justin.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Captain Stuart Claprot, representing Fairfield Chemical Carriers out of Wilton, Connecticut. We have 19,000 to 24,000 ton deadweight stainless steel parcel tankers. I don't see a direct benefit to the widening or deepening, as our major issue over the years of my time here in Houston, working for various companies, is the fog season. With a wider channel doesn't mean that we can move in fog, even if the channel is wider and deeper. There is the Pronto program, which is a trial program that some other people can maybe elucidate on. If that turns out to be the magic bullet to alleviate congestion, avoid unnecessary transit of the Houston Ship Channel, and widening the channel is deemed necessary as part of the Pronto program, then I could see the benefit to the widening and deepening project. As per your website, the Port of Houston supports the creation of nearly 1.3 million jobs in Texas and 3.2 million jobs nationwide, and economic activity totaling $339 billion in Texas, 2.6% of the state's total gross domestic product, and more than $801.9 billion in economic impact across the nation. That being said, other stakeholders who obviously benefit the most from should also be looked at to coming up with funding of these projects. That is also the communities of Harris County, Galveston, and Fort Bend counties, as well as somebody mentioned here going up to the state and to look at the rainy day funds. My personal view is that possibly the money is better spent off developing outlying Texas ports, which may be more competitive, such as Freeport, Beaumont, the Golden Triangle, and Port Lavaca, Point Comfort. In this prolonged poor chemical market, which chemical carriers have faced since 2008, since the Great Recession, we've been battling to stay in the black. Most chemical carriers, parcel carriers, are with operating the smaller ships, are operating in the red, and I can't see another tariff or cost or fee on shipping as working. For us, working on your calculations that you had up there, we're looking at about another $1,100 per transit. We're not as big as Oddfell in the port, but with growing business, we're looking at possibly a few dozen movements a year. But this is just another thing. As the Oddfell representative mentioned, we're not cost plus. We're all scrambling to be more efficient and to keep our costs under control. And this is just another one of many. Suppliers, vendors, pilots, agents, you name it, are all trying to go after this golden goose. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We don't want to kill the golden goose.
Yes, sir.
Can we continue to lay the eggs? Thank you. Any questions? Okay, thank you very much. Anybody else? Yes, sir.
Good morning. My name is Chuck Zabriskie. I'm here speaking privately. I'm a 30-year investment banker, familiar with the energy industry, midstream in specific, and comments this morning I think were very interesting, but to the point, this is a huge project for Houston. I think the merits have been laid out very clearly. Private industry here stands to benefit significantly. They need to move volumes, and they need to move them in the next few years. Getting this done in 30 or 31 is really not interesting to industry, in my understanding. Let's put this in perspective. 500 million barrels of commodity storage on the ship channel, $500 million to raise. That's $1 per barrel. Those barrels cost $100 to build. The idea that coming up with $1 to support $100 of investment, we're just talking the storage barrels, not the refineries, not the petchem plants behind that. This is not a heavy lift for industry. It's a difficult thing to decide who pays how much. I sympathize with Vince and the coalition for having to figure that out. But this is not a need to go to the commission for its balance sheet. As a banker who spent a lot of time in structured finance, the merits are here for the case. The economics are brilliant. The capacity of the people who will benefit, as the chairman pointed out, just take a look at the 2019 financials. You do not need to go to the port to use their balance sheet. This is a structured transaction, in my opinion. The merits and the economics are there to support it. I would encourage the commission, as you have, to question and push back on why the industry either can't write checks or come up with a creative financing structure that works within the legal confines of the U.S. Code, the Ports Code, to come up as a pay-as-you-go, contribute to this project, get it done soon. It's a modest cost in the scheme of things. $4,000 on a vessel is carrying $40 million of commodity. That's not going to drive somebody to Corpus Christi. The infrastructure is here. Let's take advantage of it. Let's figure out a way for industry to come up and support the commission as they want to get this port built, this project completed. I think the wherewithal is there. But I encourage the port to ask industry to do it the right way.
Good. Thank you. Thank you. Any questions? Okay. Thank you very much. Anyone else?
Okay.
Well, I appreciate that. Let me just, before we go into executive session, Vincent, thank you for being here, and thank you for your hard work.
No, thank you.
I understand how complicated it is, even though...
I know you do.
And I know you would like to commit all of your coalition folks to writing checks, including your own company, but I know how complicated it is, and we do hope that this discussion and that we can go forward and try to come up with something that makes sense for all of us, obviously. And I think there's been a lot of good discussion about what the issues are and how we need to move forward. I think ultimately, I think it's great, number one, that we're on track with our project, that we're making great progress with the advocacy, and no matter what the outcome is, we know that this channel creates a lot of value for everyone in this room and for Harris County and the whole region. The key is we're going to get it built. The question is when, and we need to figure out that part of the equation. So I think fundamentally, I would hope that we can go back from this discussion, and Vincent, you can sharpen your pencil and figure out maybe we figure out more time to try to get into a position where the industry can honor their commitment of 50%. Ultimately, the port does have its capital, and we know that. We just need to get the other part of the equation finished. So we want to definitely expedite this process and proposal, and we appreciate your time and effort in working on it. But we obviously need to do better, and we'll work with you as a partner to try to get there. I have some lunches coming up with some of the other CEOs that we'll talk to, as well as maybe we need to give you some help in that regard.
So I appreciate that. So we'll go ahead and then adjourn the meeting to executive session. We will then also take about a 10-minute break between now and the executive session.
Thank you.
Board Commission of the Port of Houston Authority of Harris County, Texas will now convene a closed meeting as permitted by the Texas Open Meetings Act and Government Code to conduct a private consultation with attorneys, including consultation regarding 33 USCA 5B and 2236, deliberate regarding real estate, including disposition of Falcon Island, Turning Basin, and Bellway 8, Barber's Cut Terminal vicinity properties, economic development negotiations or incentives, employment evaluation of public officers and employees and secure related matters. Court Commission will reconvene in public session after the closed meeting.
Back into open session at 11:54. Okay, so do we have a motion from someone?
I'd say this has been a good meeting.
So I'll take a motion. Absolutely.
Go ahead.
I move to authorize the Port Authority to purchase property in the vicinity of the Turning Basin Terminal from Rains Land and Properties LP on the terms discussed in executive session and authorize the executive director to do all things necessary to give effect to the foregoing.
Second. Okay, I have one last thing. This is more of a direction for access rights. I direct the staff immediately to seek construction access rights to the Port Authority's Beltway property to support site preparation. This property will be used for placement of dredge materials for the deepening and widening of Project 11, Segment 4, a channel reach that will benefit many of our industry partners. So staff, will you please go get some rights for construction access?
Second.
It's not a motion, it's a direction.
Oh, a direction.
That's all. They're just directed.
Yeah. Okay.
I don't think the port has to move, right?
Yeah.
No. Okay, great. All right, any other business?
That's it.
Okay, great. Our next meeting is, what is it? 24th of March, I believe. It's on this list, but we will see you at the next meeting. So all fair to say aye for adjournment.
Aye.